we discovered that industrial manufacturing facilities were, like us, flying a bit below the radar, and also, like us, providing investors with very attractive upside. The manufacturing sector has strong fundamentals, solid cap rates, healthy contractual rent bumps, long-term dependable leases, and somewhat of an inefficient transaction marketplace. And all of that made it clear to us that we were onto something.
Hello and welcome to the REIT Report. I'm your host, Sarah Borkson-Quito. Today, I'm pleased to be joined by Aaron Halfacre, CEO of Modiv Industrial, for an inside look at developments in industrial manufacturing and how the REIT has positioned itself to weather consumer trends and economic cycles. Aaron, thanks so much for joining the podcast today.
Sarah, thank you for having me. It's a real honor, privilege to be invited, and it's good to connect in between REIT conferences.
Absolutely. Modiv Industrial is the only public REIT exclusively focused on industrial manufacturing assets. How did that come about, and which REITs do you consider your peers today?
Yeah, Modiv's evolution to become the only public REIT focused on industrial manufacturing facilities was deliberate, yet also nonlinear. We started out as a diversified net lease REIT, just like numerous other public peers have in the past. But as we continued to recycle non-core properties, we discovered that industrial manufacturing facilities were, like us, flying a bit below the radar, and also, like us, providing investors with very attractive upside potential. The manufacturing sector has strong fundamentals, solid cap rates, healthy contractual rent bumps, long-term dependable leases, and somewhat of an inefficient transaction marketplace. All of that made it clear to us that we were onto something. Even though this industrial subsector offers compelling durability and favorable economics, we found that the asset class truly resonated with our team, and that was just as important to us. See, we're a hard scrabble, grit grind, get it done type of team. Think blue collar work shirt rather than white collar dress shirt. We really found ourselves intuitively understanding the tenants, the communities that our properties are located in, and the hardworking individuals across the nation. To us, it seemed first nature to focus on real estate assets where things are being made. As such, in the past 24 months, we've acquired over $200 million in industrial manufacturing assets. And this past August, after we completed the sale of a bulk of our non-core assets to GIPR, we formally proclaimed our focus strategy with a slight name change and a bell ringing on the New York Stock Exchange. As it relates to the REIT peers, I think that is a great question, but it's not an easy question to answer. As you stated, we're the only public REIT that focuses exclusively on industrial manufacturing assets, and as such, there is no perfect peer. That said, we've been compared to many number of REITs for different aspects. For example, in terms of market capitalization, being a small cap REIT, many people compare us to Alpine Income Property Trust, but as a size comparison only, as they are externally managed and focused on retail assets. From a lease duration perspective, we've been compared to Essential Property Trust, as we both have very long lease durations. In our case, our weighted average lease term, or WALT, is over 14 years. But there again, the comparison is limited, as they are a much larger REIT and focused on retail assets as well. From an asset perspective, we've been compared to Plymouth Industrial and LXP, as both own industrial with some single-tenant exposure, but both of those REITs focus on distribution or warehouse assets, and they also have multi-tenant properties. I suppose you could make a very loose comparison to Gladstone Commercial, as they have recently been acquiring some manufacturing assets like us, and they're also a small-cap REIT, but they are technically a diversified REIT with 40% in office properties with short-term leases. While some identify the peers that we might be compared to, I tend to focus on the REITs that we see buying industrial manufacturing assets, even if they do so for reasons different than we do. A little factoid, the biggest public buyer of the asset class, historically that is, was Store Capital. Now that they've gone private, we don't see them anymore. We do sometimes see Broadstone Net Lease and Spirit Realty in the marketplace, but it seems as if they are buying as a yield play, given that they are diversified REITs with large holdings in other net lease sectors. I guess I would say that the closest peer to us, and a REIT that I very much admire, is Realty Oak Realty Trust out of Rochester, New York. They have a great team led by Dan Goldstein, a very nice portfolio, and are similar in size to us.
Great. And Aaron, how would you describe the outlook for industrial manufacturing sector today?
Well, right now we're seeing what is being called a manufacturing supercycle, meaning the United States is benefiting from a pronounced investment in the manufacturing sector. The reshoring movement is bringing previously imported goods and manufacturing jobs back to U.S. shores, and this effort is expected to continue to grow over the next decade. By the end of this year, we expect about 2 million jobs to have returned since 2010, and the nation is on track to spend over $180 billion on the construction of manufacturing facilities. It really is an exciting time for manufacturing, but that hasn't always been the case. If you go back 80 plus years, say during World War II and the decades immediately after, The United States was a leading manufacturer of the world. The majority of our GDP was created from hardworking individuals making things of value. Flash forward to the late 60s and the early 70s, we saw industrial conglomerates like General Electric start to relocate some of their manufacturing to their non-US locations, primarily to reduce their cost of goods sold, but also to avoid regulation. Then in 1989, Eastman Kodak, if you remember them, not only moved their manufacturing off US soil, but they also outsourced it to a third-party manufacturer. That really marked the pronounced beginning of what is called offshoring. That moment on, you saw other companies do the same, as well as business schools teaching future business leaders that manufacturing was a cost center, not worthy of keeping domestically, and it was better to have a perfectly aligned, just-in-time global delivery model that would allow you to pay a third-party manufacturer, with China leading the way really since 2000, to build and then ship your goods to you right when you needed them. With these changes as a backdrop, we also saw a mind shift away from a production economy toward consumption economy, away from higher paid skilled trades to lower paying service jobs. To the point today where the vast majority of our economy is predicated on Americans consuming luxury discretionary goods they can't always afford, which takes away from their ability to repay debt or build their savings, or consuming cheap disposable goods that clog landfills or pollute our climate, or consuming fast food and processed foods that contribute to our nation's grave health concerns. In our nation's multi-decade delirious state of insatiable consumption, we lost a lot of our manufacturing capabilities. However, then COVID-19 happened, where the world was shut down immediately. And soon after that, Russia invaded Ukraine, which is a nation that historically exports a large amount of steel, petrochemicals, machinery, and transport equipment. Very suddenly, that perfectly designed, just-in-time delivery model that we have all relied upon wasn't working. We could no longer get the items we wanted when we wanted them. In many ways, it was a wake-up call to companies because they realized they didn't have the supply chain security they needed to reliably obtain the goods they needed to drive revenue. If a company can't securely produce sales, then they can't as easily produce the profits that their investors demand. So no matter how much money they thought they might have saved on outsourcing manufacturing, they found themselves up the proverbial creek with their shipping containers stuck in the harbor in Shanghai. It is these very recent seismic events that have accelerated the change in narrative about manufacturing and in part brought about the so-called manufacturing supercycle. 2 million new jobs and $180 billion in manufacturing construction spending are large numbers and they're very positive. But I would tell you that there's also noise in all that goodness. What I mean by noise is that a lot of the planned spending, if you read the fine print, is focused on semiconductor manufacturing and tech. Some would argue, and I wouldn't argue against them, that the headline numbers are convenient given that we are approaching an election cycle. What I would say is that I ultimately see the spend as defensive in nature. A nation that can't build its own computers, and let's face it, there are computers in everything today, is a nation that is vulnerable. You can call it the military-industrial complex if you want, but I call it common sense. Not too many people care if it takes an extra 6 months for your t-shirts or tube socks to arrive on a container ship from somewhere globally, but we seem to get that out of shape when we can't get the chips to go in our cars, or possibly worse, our military jets. What I would gladly argue with anyone, though, is that any focus on manufacturing on U.S. soil and any dollar spent to strengthen a sector where we once dominated is a good thing. Further, I would say that here at Motive, we don't need the manufacturing supercycle to take place for investors to win because we are focused on existing manufacturing facilities that have been operating here successfully for decades. Our concentration is on existing mission-critical manufacturing sites focused on producing infrastructure-based products, manufacturers that aren't tethered to changing consumer tastes or discretionary demand cycles. We have expansive opportunities to scale Motive into a much larger reach just for the many high-quality existing facilities already up and running within the U.S. today. We see a lot of opportunity to drive growth and shareholder value by being strategic and disciplined with our investment dollars.
Aaron, how have recent capital market challenges impacted the transaction market for acquiring industrial manufacturing assets?
Ooh, Sarah, that's a good one. It's been a mess. I'd say the capital markets have been like a Three Stooges movie where everyone is getting bonked on the head, but the difference is no one is laughing. If you look at public REIT price behavior, you would think someone stuck a broom handle in the front spokes of your bicycle. It's real head over heels reversal of fortune. For some REITs and many REIT CEOs, their jobs aren't nearly as enjoyable anymore because their equity is too cheap, their debt is too expensive, and their assets are getting repriced faster than my teenagers scroll through TikTok. That said, weird as it may sound, myself and Motive feel right at home. You see, we publicly listed right at the beginning of all this mess in February of 22. Since day one, we've had no wind in our sails and choppy seas. And despite this market backdrop, we've thrived in open waters. Since I apparently seem to be prone to corny analogies and metaphors, let me go one more. Motive Industrial is that classic young, lightweight boxer who is very hungry, very disciplined, who is not afraid to fight a heavier opponent. While the bigger REITs have been enjoying their championship belts and luxury automobiles, we are living in the janitor's closet and shadowboxing in front of a grungy mirror, knowing full well that our day will come and our hand will be raised. You have to be a savvy fighter in this market environment. It isn't about if transactions are available in the marketplace, but rather if you should pursue them and to know when is the right time to do so. Let me give you an example. The last half of last year, of 2022, and the first half of this year, 2023, despite all that's happened, the markets were behaving as expected, in that bad news was bad news and good news was good news. Given that manufacturing facilities tend to be held on the manufacturer's balance sheets, we do a lot of sell-leaseback transactions. The decision to sell and lease back a manufacturing facility that you as a manufacturer have owned for years is not an easy one or a fast one. Sometimes the time it takes to decide that you're willing to do a sell-leaseback from the time you transact on it could take over a year. So the sell-leasebacks we saw last year and the first half of this year were decisions the owners had made some time ago, and they had already committed to the concept of a sell-leaseback. At the same time, we saw the buyer pool shrink due to the elimination of mortgage-dependent private buyers and a cautious pause by the aforementioned REIT peers that we talked about. As a result, we were able to acquire attractive assets at attractive cap rates when few were paying attention, fighting above our weight class, if you will.
Has Motive been actively acquiring? And if so, how do acquisitions move the needle for Motive?
Well, flash forward to today. Now, instead of being on the offensive, we have our head on a sort of defensive swivel. Why? Well, we started to notice in late August, and it became really clear in September that good news became bad news, and bad news became really bad news. The markets were no longer offering us rational signals, and that was before the horrible events of October 7th. At the same time, we have recently been questioning the current motivations of a manufacturer taking a sell-leaseback transaction to market now, a full 18 months into the market malaise. It suggested to us that the sellers actively chose to sell even though they were making the decision, unlike before, with full knowledge that the markets had turned sour. So instead of choosing to take a knee and sit out this bleak spot, they've chosen to sell at a really bad time. That further suggests to us that they either A, they don't care, or B, they are too desperate for the money. Either reason is a bad one. So right now, we are patiently minding our P's and Q's, still looking and open to acquisitions that make sense for the right reasons, but nonplussed about meeting any artificial acquisition goals. In REIT land, investors sometimes get too enamored with a REIT's acquisition pipeline, and some REITs try to deliver on acquisition goals no matter what. They can be a bad habit when you are in a bad market. That said, we are patiently keeping track of several attractive portfolios of manufacturing assets. In fact, they total over $1 billion in aggregate value. That could be an interesting play should the markets return to some level of normalcy. As it relates to your question about how acquisitions can move the needle, let me say that as a small cap REIT, one of the true benefits is what I call the denominator effect. Let me share some math as an example. Motive has about $45 million in annual rental revenue. Gladstone has 150, and Plymouth has about 200 million. All three REITs have a market cap of less than 1 billion, but Motive is clearly the smallest. If all three REITs were to go out tomorrow and buy a single $15 million unlevered acquisition at a 7.5 cap rate, then Motive's top line revenue grows by 2.5%, while the other two REITs barely move the needle. In fact, that single asset is 3 to 5 times more efficient on our balance sheet. You couple this math with the challenging capital markets, and you can see that even in these tough times, Motive can grow meaningfully and aggressively while still flying below the radar and without having to commit to large acquisition volumes.
And Aaron, what would you say are some of the unique challenges and opportunities that Motive currently faces?
Being a small or microcap REIT in a crappy capital markets is both our greatest challenge and opportunity. An experienced team with the right focus can do marvelous things with a small balance sheet, and I think our savvy investors pick up on this. That said, the REIT industry has a nearly exclusive blind bias towards larger cap REITs at the expense of smaller REITs. As a certifiable REIT nerd and a Green Street alum, I'm a big student of REIT history. Heck, give me a whiskey and a slew of historical SEC filings, and it makes for a great Friday night. History tells us that a small cap balance sheet, without doubt, magnifies the decisions of that REIT's management team. So if a small cap REIT management team has ego envy and chases deals for the sake of a deal, boom, the REIT can very well enter a death spiral straight to Zombieland. If that small cap REIT management team can't control their expenses or message themselves out of a paper bag, they are stuck like superglue to a poor cost of capital structure. However, there are examples out there where small cap REIT management teams did make the right choices and who were patient. Agri Realty is a classic example of a small cap REIT becoming a mid cap darling. And that is the opportunity for us here at Motive to turn this small but mighty REIT into a bigger and mightier REIT. In fact, this is the third public REIT that I've been at, and it's the smallest balance sheet I've ever worked with. It's an invigorating intellectual challenge that keeps me, so to speak, shadow boxing in front of that grungy mirror.
Great. And finally, Aaron, is there anything else about Motive that you would like to share for the podcast?
I can't stress enough the strength of our team and our approach, our experience and motivation. We can handle challenging economic environments, nuanced property cycles, and capricious capital markets. We believe in hard work, no BS, discipline, thoughtfulness, empathy, humility, and just really fighting for the underdog. Our solid track record, which is underpinned by a thorough investment process, is evidence of that. We're an organization that chooses to serve countless hardworking Americans by the belief that making investments in them and for them is the right thing to do. I'd say that through grit and grind, we get it done.
Excellent, Aaron. Thank you so much for your time today.
Sarah, thank you. I really appreciate it.
And to our listeners, if you enjoyed this episode of the REIT Report, please subscribe or leave a review on your favorite podcast platform.